This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Trainer Todd Pletcher has reached the stratosphere.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Moon over Miami for Bill Mott.
3,000 for trainer Mark Cassie.
Trainer D-Way Lucas, a sixth win.
And Bob Baffert with another incredible milestone.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Win number 1,000 for the great Trevor McCarthy.
Here's 2,000 for Nick Zito.
Steve Aspison is now North America's all-time leading trainer.
Now here's Mike Pena.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk, and it is all presented by Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, happy to have you back in the starting gate with me for the next hour on Sirius 162, XM 207, streaming worldwide at horseracingradio.net and available anywhere you get your podcasts each and every week. Well, my guest on today's show has spent the past 9 years of his life honing his craft while learning from one of the best. He will begin yet another chapter on May 1st when he officially opens his own public training stable. He first joined us here on Trainer Talk in 2018, and at that time, he was newly married. He was getting ready to spend a few months working at Woodbine in Toronto, but so much has changed since that time for the 27-year-old who grew up on his grandfather's farm in Nicholasville, Kentucky. He is Nolan Ramsey, and he is kind enough to spend the next hour with me here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Nolan, really appreciate the time and the visit, my friend.
Oh, thank you for having me on. Looking forward to it.
It's incredible. As I was preparing for this show here today, I went back and listened to some of our conversation from 2018. And my goodness, to think about where you were just 6 years ago and where things are going with your life and with your career right now, It's night and day, isn't it?
Yeah, sure is. Things have changed a lot, but then when you kind of step back and look at the progress, it's quite exciting to see all the changes. You know, you get so caught up in it, you don't really realize how much has changed till you take a breath and really look at it. So, big step, big change, but really looking forward to it.
This decision didn't come just out of left field. You had been considering this move for a long time. This was always the goal, even when you started working with Mike Maker some 9 years ago. So tell me about making this decision and why now is the right time.
Yeah, it's definitely something I've had in the back of my head for quite a while. I bet I've got some things that are pushing me to make the decision. I felt like time is right. One of the bigger factors is my grandfather, he's in his late 80s and he's not getting any younger. I'd really, really like to win some races for the family before the opportunity's gone. So that's kind of been in the back of my mind. And then with Mike, I've done a lot of traveling. You know, I've been in a lot of different tracks. It's more of that gypsy lifestyle. But I've got two young kids and just trying to be a little bit more control of my schedule, being the one that can take a day off or something if I need to tend to the family. So the kids definitely pushing me to have a little bit more stability in my career. Not that it's ever going to be easy, but being in control of it a little bit more is pushing me to make the decision. And then I started talking with a few guys, some people that are along the years have always said, when you're ready, we'll support you. So I started getting some positive feedback, and I just started to feel like maybe the time was right.
All right, two things from those comments. First of all, when you talk to your grandfather, you would never know that he was in his late 80s because he walks around and has an enthusiasm for the sport and for life, which is like a 27-year-old, right? It seems as if he's your age. And then secondly, trainers don't get days off. What do you mean you want to be in control of your days off? It doesn't happen.
Days off, no. You know, with my grandfather, I'm 27 myself, and I still can't keep up with him. I mean, his enthusiasm is unmatched. I even at a walking pace, you can't keep up with him, but he lives and breathes horse racing. You know, any conversation we have, I don't think I could recall a conversation where horses didn't come up. I mean, he just lives for it. So, you know, have somebody like that backing you is unique and special and definitely a big opportunity. The enthusiasm he has for the game, and then, you know, the family connection also, it's just a good story. It makes him feel good. I know he's always wanted me to do it. So when I approached him about the idea, he was very supportive, very excited. So I know he's looking forward to it. And then on the days off, you know, I'd like to be able to take an afternoon to spend with the kids or see a soccer game or a ballet recital, that type of thing. You know, I got to be able to do that. This is a 7 day a week, 365 day a year job. But just being able to have just a little bit of free time to spend with the kids is really important to me moving forward.
Yeah, we don't want to take advantage of the fact that people automatically assume, or that we automatically assume, that people know who your grandfather is when we're referring to your grandfather. That is, of course, Eclipse Award winning owner Ken Ramsey, perennial leading owner in the game. He has been to the highest levels and in recent years has scaled things back a little bit with his operation, but that enthusiasm for the sport and his passion for the game has not left. And then you talk about the, you know, spending time with the kids. That's something that when you said it, I immediately thought back to one of my initial conversations on this program with Todd Pletcher when he was talking about not being there for all of his kids' soccer games and the moments that he had to miss because of training racehorses. And that's a very real thing, isn't it, Nolan?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's one of the toughest parts of this type of career. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, the horses can't take care of themselves. And you've always got to be there. You've always got to tend to business. And you miss a lot. You know, and even as an assistant, I've missed, you know, family gatherings. I've missed weddings. I've missed funerals. You know, things that, you know, I really should have been there for. And you know, I understand that you can't just up and leave for a week when you want, but, you know, just having a little bit of time to maybe not miss as many of those things as one would like is really important to me, especially with my kids being as young as they are. You know, I want to be there for them. I want to be able to support them, but still got to be able to manage, you know, running a stable as well. So it's definitely tricky. So I definitely feel for what Pletcher was saying on missing things, because it's a very realistic reality.
There is a big difference between being a head trainer and being an assistant trainer. What gives you the confidence, Nolan, that you are ready to be the boss?
You know, there's been a couple of times, in recent memory, Woodbine was a good example. While I was there, I had a large string of horses, and Mike's really trusted me to, do as I please, but, you know, to run the barn in the matter, I feel is right. You know, as far as picking races, naming jocks, you know, their daily training schedule, he's given me a lot of free rein. And I've seen the results. You know, the horses have run well. You know, the horses that I've managed have done well. And there's been a handful of horses that, you know, as big of a trainer as Mike is, there's horses that come into the barn. You know, he may never actually see them or may not, you know, work with them. So it just kind of encouraged me that, you know, my work was well represented in the afternoons, and it gave me some confidence.
Mike Maker has trained 3,319 winners as of the recording of this program here today. What is it about Mike Maker that makes him such a good trainer?
You know, he's very, very sharp. He's an excellent horseman. He can look at a horse and tell you exactly what's wrong with it. And I think he can read a condition book just as good as anybody. The spots he picks for his horses, nine times out of 10, when we lead them up, we're competitive. You know, it's very rarely do we head up to the paddock thinking, hey, you know, maybe this isn't the right spot. And then just the range of the quality of horses in the barn, I think has been very beneficial for me learning. You know, we've got the nickel claimers and we've got the grade one winners and we've got everything in between. So, you know, I know not all barns are like that. So to be able to work with all those different kinds of horses, you know, your claimers, your starter allowance, your stakes horses, I think it's very beneficial because you see a lot of different quality horses. You see a lot of different things and you can learn from them.
Do you have to approach each of those types of horses differently when you're working with them?
In some respect, yeah. Some of the horses you're going to do things differently or maybe treat them differently than you would the next, but you know, at the end of the day, you know, or you feed them the same, you care for them the same. You know, maybe we tweak their training a little bit here and there, but, It's been very beneficial to sit there and actually work in the same barn that Mike's at, you know, the majority of my time with him, and seeing, you know, where he might take a horse that, you know, I can't figure out or something doesn't make sense to me, and watch what he does with the horse and the little things that he tweaks and what a difference it makes. It's been very, very good for me to watch that. I've been very, very fortunate to be able to work, you know, side by side with Mike. You know, we spend the winters together in Florida. You know, I've been in New York in the summers several years, you know, so I'm where he's at a lot of the time, and that's really been important to me.
People that see Mike Maker publicly in television interviews, they hear him here on the radio with me doing radio interviews, they'll know Mike Maker isn't always the most verbose type of interviewer, right? or at least interviewee. He doesn't always come across as the guy who's going to, you know, spend 30 minutes giving you a long answer. But he's very smart, and he's very to the point. So when you're working with Mike and he's teaching you, what's that like? Is he more open and outgoing when he's working with you and teaching the staff?
Yeah, and, you know, maybe I have a little bit different of a situation than when most. You know, he was working for Wayne Lucas when my grandparents had horses with Wayne. So I was running around the barn when I was, you know, 5 and 6 years old, so he's known me a long time. You know, we're very comfortable with one another, so I don't ever feel like there's a question I can't ask, or you know, I can't speak up and voice my opinion or ask him why it is he does this or why it is he does that. You know, where maybe his quietness might intimidate some, I guess. But you know, I've also learned too, you know, he doesn't say much, so when he does speak, you best listen.
Yeah.
And yeah, and like I said, you know, just being able to be comfortable with him and pick his brain, you know, we'll sit there and I'll ask him, you know, why did you enter this horse here? You know, why did we change this with the feed? You know, why did we tweak this with the training? And when you ask him questions, he'll open up and he'll give you a good answer. You got to ask for it.
Yep. Yeah, talking with Nolan Ramsey here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. He is getting ready after spending the past 9 years as an assistant for trainer Mike Maker. He's getting ready to go on his own starting on May 1st, and that is really exciting, but it's a little bit scary too, I would imagine, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, when you sit down, you write it all out on paper and look at it, it may not seem like the smartest idea, but you know, I'm excited. You know, it runs in my family. I've always wanted to do it, so I got some confidence, so I think I'd like to try my hand at it.
We started talking a little bit about your grandfather and his enthusiasm and his passion, and people that see him even today will know that that's a real thing. Take me back to the beginning, growing up around the farm, being around your grandfather as a little kid. Take me back through those early days of Nolan Ramsey.
Yeah, we grew up on the farm. Our house was about a half mile from his, so typically I'd get home from school and I'd ride my bike over to his house, and I still remember his office. It was a mess. You couldn't find his desk. It was buried in buried in old racing forms. He had a almost like a tunnel dug out to his desk, but I remember we'd go to his house. I'd sit on a stack of racing forms. We'd watch the races, and I was hooked, and I really liked it. And from a very young age, he started teaching me how to read the racing form, how to read a condition book. So you know, it was fun for me. We'd go over there, we'd look at the form, and we'd watch some races. You know, he'd challenge me to pick a winner, to you know, pick the exactor, pick the trifecta. It was, you know, that's how I started. And I mean, I was 7, 8 years old, and he saw how much I enjoyed it. You know, once I, you know, was old enough to start traveling with him too, he would take me to all these different tracks and we could watch all these different races. And, you know, I was very fortunate. I got to go to, you know, all sorts of different racetracks in different countries, different states, all over the place, and take part in all of it. And I was hooked. I came back when I was, probably 9, big enough to handle a horse. I started working on the farm in the summers with the broodmares and the foals, which was good. It was a good learning experience, but it was a little slow for me. And then he would take me to Saratoga in the summers too. He put me through what he called his handicapping school. And, you know, it was like going to school. We would go to the races, we'd watch the races. When we left the track that day, we'd pick up our form for the next day. And when we got home, he'd sit me down at the kitchen table, and he'd set a clock for 2 hours. Nobody was allowed to get up. Nobody was allowed to talk. You had to sit there and handicap each race. And then when we were done with the card, we'd sit there and go race by race and discuss, you know, why we like the horses we like, you know, how we saw the race is going to unfold. And we do that all summer long. So, you know, after the first couple of years, I became a pretty good handicapper. I could read a form really, really well. And, you know, that's kind of what started it was, you know, the reading the form and picking winners. I really liked that. So while I was in Saratoga, Mike had offered me a job in the mornings walking hots for him. So I said, well, I'll try it. You know, that sounds interesting. I enjoyed working with the horses hands-on at the farm. So I started walking hots for him in the summer. And I'll tell you what, the first day, I knew I wasn't going to leave. I couldn't get enough of it. I loved coming to the barn in the morning, working with the horses, you know, learning how it all worked. You know, an owner may see the game very differently than the trainer does. So to be able to have, you know, an understanding of how both sides of the racetrack worked was eye opening for me. And once I started working with the horses, I never looked back.
A lot of people will hear you talk about that handicapping school and what you went through learning how to read the racing form and to study the races in depth the way you did. Your grandfather is known as the king of the pick six, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
He's done really well throughout his handicapping career. So if you were to take me inside his handicapping mind, what has made him so successful over the years as a horse player and as a handicapper?
You know, he's very strategic. You know, he's not one that bets every race. He's not one that'll, you know, place the easy wagers. He's not a win place show kind of guy. You know, he likes to wheel in the trifectas. He likes his pick fours, his pick sixes, the challenging bets, the higher risk but higher reward type bets. And you know, that's one thing he really hammered into me was, you know, being strategic, being able to see, you know, how the race is going to unfold, try to find that one long shot that maybe could light up the ticket. And I remember one summer we went up and his rule was the whole time we were there, the only wagers that we were allowed to place the entire summer were pick sixes. And that was it. No win bets, no exactas, nothing else, only pick sixes. And my cousin William was with me that summer. We were probably 11 or 12, 12 or 13, young. And we hit three pick sixes that summer.
Wow.
And I specifically remember when we packed up to leave Saratoga, we were flying home. Now, my grandfather at the window, instead of taking a check, he wanted cash for his winnings. So when we got to the airport, we had roughly $75,000, $80,000 cash on us, which he decided he was going to split up between the three of us to carry home. Now, me being 12, I had no idea. I said, okay, no problem. I put about 20 in my pockets, and I headed on into the airport. So when we went through the TSA check, I went first, and you know, he told us, oh, you know, you need to keep it in your pockets. And, you know, we're young. We said, okay, sounds good. So that's what we did. And as soon as I went through the detectors, they did a pat down and noticed I had something in my pockets and pulled me aside. So I'm sitting there all nervous. And about 2 or 3 minutes later, here came my cousin. They got him too. And then lastly, here came my grandfather. So the three of us are sitting in the detention deal at the TSA with about $75,000 cash on us. Thankfully, we had our IRS receipt so we could prove where we got it. But I told the same story to my parents when I got home, and my parents weren't they didn't find it as funny as I did or he did. But you know, it's just one memory that stuck out to me. I mean, he hammered it into us. He made sure we enjoyed it and we were having fun, but also always made sure we were a part of it too.
That's such a great story, and I'm glad you brought up your parents too, because there are an awful lot of parents out there who would put their foot down and say, no, you're not going to be spending all this time with your grandfather because he's teaching you how to handicap and how to bet. And they would look at that as being a negative. It doesn't sound to me like your parents really held you back. They let you go and do that. So what was their reaction when you started hanging out with grandpa and getting a feel for handicapping and betting?
Well, if I remember correctly, I think it was a split decision. I think my dad was okay with it because he saw how much I enjoyed it, and I think he had a better understanding of you know the horses than what my mother did. Obviously, when you're talking about a young child and gambling, my mother's face didn't really light up when presented the idea of teaching me how to read the racing form and going to the track, but. You know, she saw how much I liked it and how passionate I was about it, and eventually they gave my grandfather the okay. So, like I said, you know, once he was given the okay, he taught me everything he knew.
You now have a 2-year-old daughter of your own. You have a young son. Will you teach them how to handicap and how to bet at a young age?
That's tough. That's real tough. They're going to know how to read the racing form. Whether I let them bet or not might be a different conversation. But you know, my daughter, even at 2 years old, you know, she loves petting on the horses, seeing the horses. You know, she's definitely not timid at all. You know, my son's still pretty young, so we'll see how he is. But I always find it interesting. It almost seems like the itch for the horses skips a generation. My grandfather's got. Four kids of his own, and you know, none of them are hands-on. None of them work at the racetrack. You know, they enjoy the racing, they follow it, but you know, they don't have that same passion that he has. And you know, I've got it, and one of my cousins is big into it. He's not hands-on though. You know, I'm the only one really in the family that you know works on the backside and you know gets in there and deals with them you know themselves. And you know, I want to make sure that my kids have the opportunity. To do that if that's what they choose to do. But if they choose otherwise, then I support them in anything they do.
Do you feel like all of that experience you gained handicapping, reading a condition book, has really helped you as you've started to begin this, well, I guess begin is probably the wrong word because you've been doing it a long time as an assistant to Mike, but now as you go out on your own, all of that experience you've gained on that side of things is helping you as a horse trainer now?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that knowledge is priceless. I think there's so many races won and lost in just reading the condition book alone. You know, to be able to read the conditions and understand the type of horses that are going to be in any given race, you know, I think it's imperative. You have to have that knowledge. You know, without a solid understanding of how to read a racing form or condition book, you know, I think you're left pretty vulnerable. You know, obviously the horsemanship side and being able to, you know, train the horse is extremely important too, but you know, you got to have both sides of it. It's you know, it's imperative. You have to have it.
Are you goal oriented, Nolan? And if so, will there be certain goals that you'll set for yourself when you open up the new stable on May 1st?
Yeah, I do have some goals. I've got some pretty lofty ones, and then I've got some more realistic ones as well. You know, right off the bat, you know, I'd really like my first win to be for my grandfather. You know, I don't know how that'll shake out because I've got some other guys that are gonna be backing me as well. So you know, I'm not gonna work it to where that you know happens, but I'd like it to unfold that way. You know, and it's funny, I was on the phone with him yesterday. You know, we're talking about. You know, taking horses to Maryland, and that's one of the very few areas he's not very active in. He's never had horses stabled there, so not only is it new for me, it's kind of new for him too. So, you know, I'd like to show up and try and you know, I don't know, leave a footprint or make a mark or leave an impression on the Maryland circuit with him as well. He's, you know him well. He's extremely competitive. So I'd definitely like to be able to show up there and at least leave a mark there. But as far as the bigger goals go, you know, I got a few races in mind that, you know, some point in my career, I hope to be fortunate enough to win. You know, I think every trainer's goal is probably to win the Kentucky Derby. You know, that's at the top of the list. And I know that's at the top of his list as well. You know, he's one that's won, you know, just about every big race there is to win, except for the Derby. That one's eluded him. You know, whether I'm going to be fortunate enough to get him there or not, it's a completely different story. But him and I share that goal in common.
Why did you decide on Maryland?
You know, Maryland's, I think it's a good spot to be, especially starting out. eventually I'd like to get to Kentucky. Kentucky's home for me. I'm impartial. You know, I like it there, but I thought Maryland had a lot of opportunity. It's looking like probably going to be heavier on the turf side than I am the dirt. So Maryland's got a lot of turf options. I think that their book's going to fit the type of horses that I'll have. And then also the location. It'll be a place, you know, between Pimlico and Laurel. I won't really have to move and be able to race in the same circuit year round, which kind of also goes back to the family aspect of it, being able to be a little more stable. So that played part in it. But also there's a lot of opportunity. There's a lot of surrounding tracks and a short van ride. You can be, you know, at half a dozen different tracks. So I really like the location. I thought the opportunity was there. You know, I think I'm going to be fortunate enough to get enough stalls, you know, to be able to grow a little bit as well. So I thought that was the right place to be. Kentucky's great. I love Kentucky, but it's so saturated, and it's tough. It's very, very tough. So I thought that might be a little bit too tough of a place to try to break in, you know, right off the start. But I thought Maryland kind of gave me everything I needed.
Kentucky has become so much more challenging over the past few years because of all the money that's being offered across the board there, right?
Absolutely. You know, you look at the overnight, and every field's a full field with extras, and you know, it's hard enough just getting a horse in a race, much less getting stall space and being able to grow and compete. It's become, in my opinion, I think it's probably the toughest circuit there is.
Also, maybe the most lucrative.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, and that goes for breeders, that goes for owners, that goes for trainers, which really, I mean, it makes it tough, but it benefits everybody if you can be successful.
Absolutely. No, there's, you know, Kentucky's great. You know, New York has got a very solid program as well. You know, there's some big money out there. There's really big money, and I'm not saying I won't ship in here and there, but starting out, you know, I need to find a place that's going to be able to suit me, suit the quality horses that I'll have, and, you know, a place where I can get, you know, lots of starts and try to get my numbers up. You know, Kentucky's tough. Like I said, just trying to get a horse in a race is a challenge in its own, much less winning.
Yeah, and I guess you can look at that two different ways, right? It can be a negative for that person that's being excluded in those races, but, boy, it's a positive for the industry as a whole.
Oh, no, that's absolutely. Kentucky should be the you know, the leader in the industry in anybody's opinion. You know, their program is second to none, and you know, really, I wish everywhere was like Kentucky. You know, I think everybody does. So, you know, love to be able to support the Kentucky program in the future.
Nolan, I got to get to a commercial break here. Stay with me. We're back in about 2 minutes. We're going to talk more about your career, where you're heading, and we're going to look back on some of the top moments that you have shared alongside Mike Maker and alongside your grandfather. We'll do that next. This is Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Nominate now for this year's Fasig Tipton Selected Yearling Sales. The July Sale. A strong market for precocious and athletic yearlings that attract the sport's leading end users. Last year, 40% of yearlings sold brought $100,000 or more. The 103rd Saratoga Sale. The crown jewel of American yearling sales, Saratoga set new sale records for the second year in a row, including the highest price yearling sold in the world in 2023.
Tice upstairs, $4 million even.
New York Bred Yearlings, the number one marketplace for New York breds, held during the Saratoga race meet. Selected sales, superior results. Visit selectedyearlings.fasigtipton.com to nominate now and rise above the crowd at our 2024 Selected Yearling Sales.
It's time to get ready for the 2024 Thoroughbred season at Woodbine Racetrack, the number one turf track in North America. Season runs from April to December with over $62 million in purses with an industry-leading stakes program including two Canadian Classics, the Grade 1 Million Dollar Rico Woodbine Mile and the Million Dollar King's Plate. Woodbine offers top safety-rated racing and training services, plus world-class facilities. Make Woodbine your home turf this season. Learn more at woodbine.com.
perennial leading consigner Eddie Woods once again offers a strong consignment at this year's OBS March 2-Year-Old and Training Sale, March 12th to the 14th. With juveniles by promising freshman sires, Authentic, Complexity, Echo Town, Game Winner, Global Campaign, Higher Power, Improbable, Instagram, McKinsey, and Promises Fulfilled, you'll be sure to find your next winner at the Eddie Woods consignment. Visit eddiewoods.com.
There are plenty of thrills at Gulfstream Park with live thoroughbred action Friday through Sunday and simulcasting 7 days a week. Join us on track for weekend stakes races and make plans for opening day of the championship meet on Friday, December 1st. Dine trackside in 10 Ponds with an elevated view of the track and grab a cool cocktail in the Carousel Club. For reservations, tickets, and more, head to GulfstreamPark.com.
Well, Fasig's family, basically. Some of the guys that work here I've known for 30 years. I just felt really supported, and they're great communicators. They try to help in whatever you do.
Fasig Tipton has a sale for every market, every segment in the industry. There's multiple opportunities where you're going to have plenty of good buying and selling situations.
Great customer service. I'm not only a buyer with them, but I'm a seller, and I've always been well taken care of.
There's a lot of different things that sometimes you need at a sale, and Fasig Tipton is there every step of the way.
They show year after year that they're ethical and they're fair, and they enjoy what they do. But when you're around people that have a combination of all those things, you know, you can't lose.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Nolan's Cat trails into the stretch on the outside, da-da-da-dum. Now moves by, gets the lead. Opens it out to 2.5. Papal is second. Here comes Nolan's Cat gaining ground. The da-da-dum has the lead. Nolan's Cat on the outside. That's going to be close. That's a photo. Nolan's Cat on the outside with the da-da-dum in a photo, then Papal.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on HRRN. Mike Battaglia with the call of a claiming race at Turfway in 2009, January 8th of that year to be exact. It was won by Nolan's Cat, tight finish, but it was Nolan's Cat who got to the wire first in what would be his final career start. Nolan's Cat, named for my guest on today's show, Nolan Ramsey, named by his grandfather, Ken Ramsey, and competed in the Belmont Stakes, if you recall, in 2005, finished third that year, and went on to win some five races from 26 career starts, and wrapping it up with that win at Turfway Park. And always great to work in Mike Battaglia's call, and always great to welcome Nolan to the program. He joined me back in 2018, and if you are just tuning into the show and you missed the first half, you missed a lot, because he walked through what's been happening over the last 6 years as he gets ready to embark on his own training career after 9 years with Mike Maker as his assistant. He will do that on May 1st, and we'll continue to talk more about some of his favorite memories here in the second half of the program. But I want to remind you, if you missed any portion of this show or any of our Trainer Talk shows, head over to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can listen whenever you have some time. You can do that too on every single podcast platform. Just type in Horse Racing Radio Network and follow along with all the shows we bring you each and every week. Nolan, how cool was that? Working in Mike Battaglia, number one, and then getting a chance to hear that name, Nolan's Cat, called again. Cool horse.
Yeah, sure is. You mentioned the Belmont. You know, my bedroom at home in Lexington, I've got the Belmont Stakes webbing that they give you is hanging on the wall with Nolan's Cat's name on it. He was a cool horse. A lot of memories.
Nobody's ever named a horse after me. So what's it like to have a horse and a horse competing in a Triple Crown race that was named for you?
No, it was special. I remember, you know, a Fleet Alex was the horse. You know, we knew we weren't going to win, but we knew we had a shot going into the Belmont, and he brought everybody. The entire family flew up for the race. You know, we were a big long shot that day, and to see him hit the board was pretty special. You know, and I was young, so that was really neat. And even before him, there was another one that Nick Zito trained named Rolling with Nolan.
He was
a pretty special horse too. And I was home a couple weeks ago doing some work in my closet. I found this box and pulled it out, and man, there was four or five big binders full of wind photos. And I started, sifting through those, looking at all those. And I found a picture, I believe it was 1999 at Gulfstream. Rolling with Nolan had won, and I would have been 3 or 4, I guess I'd have been 4 at the time. And I had my big red Rolling with Nolan button on in the winner's circle. And, it was just one of those memories. You just sit there and look at the picture and smile. It's very special to have a horse named after you, especially one that wins or, gets on the big stage. And that's something he's always done. He's always named horses after family members. He's had some really good ones too. And, right now he's got one here in South Florida with Safi Joseph that's named after my daughter. So, those horses are always a little special to you.
Oh yeah, they're fantastic and especially when they turn out to be pretty good. The name that will pop into everybody's mind is Stephanie's Kitten, right?
Yes,
winner of the
absolutely.
Breeders' Cup Filly and Mare Turf, and just there were so many though, but Stephanie's Kitten was at another level.
Absolutely.
Yeah, really cool stuff. Nolan Ramsey here with me on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Nolan's cat giving him a lot of thrills early on, but there were plenty of others too. Talk to me about some of the horses that you were around early on with your grandfather that you're never going to forget.
I specifically remember the Breeders' Cup at Lone Star. He came in with two pretty big horses, Kitten's Joy and Roses in May. It was a cool experience. I'd never been to Texas. It was a new track. I hadn't seen it, and it was the Breeders' Cup, all the excitement around it and having two, big time horses there, competing in two of the biggest races. There's a lot of publicity and, I was looking at some old photos. I found a picture of me on the backside of Lone Star. I had my, black cowboy hat. I think I had snakeskin cowboy boots on, my jeans and my button-down shirt. And I had all of my buttons. I had my buttons on my shirt for my grandfather's horses. And, growing up, having that type of horse, to have a winner is one thing, but to have horses that compete at, those types of races, I mean, it's, maybe I didn't appreciate it as much when I was little, but, working with horses and now being a trainer on my own, you really appreciate when you get a good horse, and he's had so many of them, and to be there and be in the winner's circle, to be able to lead them in, to be a part of it all is extremely special.
Nolan, you were featured in a I Am Horse Racing piece that aired on Blood Horse in 2020, or at least it was posted on Blood Horse in 2020. And you talked about Henley's Joy, who is a horse that you got to be around with Mike Maker, and Henley's Joy was owned by my good friend Jeff Bloom and Bloom Racing. And you said in that video, you said Henley's Joy was always one of your favorites because he messed with you and he tested you. What does that mean? How do horses test you?
He's one of those horses, and even now, his personality's never changed. You get in the stall with him and he's playful, but you also got to watch him. He's like a little kid, playful, but maybe doesn't know the limits or doesn't really realize how big he is. But I always loved him. You could go up to the stall, you put your hand out, and he's going to come out and mess with you and, try to get a reaction out of you. And then, I get in the stall and do the same to him. And, every horse is different. Every horse has their own personalities, but his was very special, very unique. And then, obviously being a offspring of Kitten's Joy, there was a connection there. And then for him to accomplish what he did as a racehorse, he was a grade one winner. He won the Belmont Derby. So to have a horse that's special to you, that, you have a connection with, and then to see him go out there and win a big race like that definitely makes it even more unique. And story on him, he changed hands. He went to a couple of different trainers, but we had the opportunity this past Kentucky Downs to claim him, and we did, and we got him back. So I had him in my barn here at Gulfstream this winter, and actually he just won for us about a month ago. And just to stand in the winner's circle with him one more time was a good memory. I always liked that horse.
Yep, I'm glad you led me there because I was going to bring that up. And it's interesting because I have a segment on my Saturday morning equine forum show that I do every week with Dale Romans and Tim Wilkin. And we talk about some of the hot topics of the week. And I brought that up to them after Henley's Joy won at Gulfstream Park on January 31st. It ended a 34-race losing streak that spanned 4.5 years. So it was a really special win on a lot of levels. And I asked Dale and Tim if that isn't the moment of the year in 2024 already. And it's going to be hard to top that moment. And I could hear you getting a little emotional when you talked about it.
Yeah, the last race he won for us was the Belmont Derby. He went winless since then. You know, we saw him in for the tag at Kentucky Downs, and, it wasn't cheap. He was in for $62,500, and to look at a horse's form that hadn't won in that long, it's a tough sell. But, we'd done well with the horse. We knew the horse. The horse responded to our program. So, we were fortunate enough to have some owners that, put up the money and to get a win. And it was funny, too. It was just an allowance race. It wasn't anything special. It was just, your regular afternoon. There was nothing special about the race, but when that horse won, I got more phone calls, text messages than winning a stakes race. Everybody knew what that horse meant to me, and to get him to the winner's circle with us there, it was cool to see how many people remembered the horse, knew what I thought of him. To have those type of people reach out and say something just over a little allowance race at Gulfstream Park on a Thursday afternoon, It was nice. It was really nice. It was very rewarding.
What other horses have tested you the way Henley's Joy tested you?
One comes to mind was Sir Dudley Diggs. He was purchased with the intent of being the queen, well, now the King's Plate horse. And he had talent. He had a lot of talent. We really liked him, but he was just one of those horses that we just couldn't get him to break his maiden. I mean, he was always right there, but just never got the job done. And then from 2 to 3, he grew, he matured, he was a completely different horse. And that was like another one of my favorite memories was, I remember I took him to Woodbine, for the Queen's Plate trial. And we were a long shot. The horse still really hadn't proven himself. All he'd done to that point was break his maiden. But we knew the horse had talent and he was improving. We ran him that day, and he hit the board. He ran a good race, but he didn't win. So it was still kind of questionable, do we go to the Queen's Plate? Do we not go to the Queen's Plate? Ultimately, we decided to do it. He got added distance. We knew the horse would get the distance, and he was just getting better and better with each race. So I took the horse up to Woodbine myself. We went almost 2 weeks before the race. It was just me and him up there, training him every day. I could see how he's getting over the synthetic. I was like, this horse is, he's doing really well. And we came into the race. We were a decent price too. We didn't get a whole lot of respect. And, I remember my grandfather called me. He's like, what do you think? Do we have a shot here? I said, yeah, I think we do. And he goes, well, you better be right because the whole family's coming up. I said, well, good. I said, good. I said, bring him on. So, obviously, horse goes on to win the race. It's the first and only time he'd ever won the Queen's Plate. That was one of his bucket list races. And to be able to do it with the horse that, we'd had, we had been able to, get there with the horse, get the job done, the whole plan worked out, and then to be able to do it for my grandparents was special too. And the fact that everybody was there, we got to lead the horse in together. That's one of those memories you'll never forget.
Yeah, it was really, really special, and that's a day I never forget either. Sir Dudley Diggs was special too. He was the son of Gio Ponti. I love Gio Ponti. So when he won the Queen's Plate, now known as the King's Plate, but when he won the Queen's Plate, I think he was like 15-1. And it was just such a cool moment, even for me, sitting back and watching.
No, and that horse, he was such a solid horse. I mean, he showed up every time he ran. And even after that, that might be the only horse I'd have to look, but I'm pretty sure that's the only horse that I've ever had my hands on that's a stakes winner in 3 different countries.
Ooh,
He won the Queen's Plate at Woodbine. He won a stakes race at Kentucky Downs, and then he rewarded us with the Barbados Gold Cup as well. So yep. that was a very unique situation, bringing in a horse like him to Barbados. You know, there was a lot of publicity on him being, you know, the Queen's Plate winner. They'd never had a horse of that quality, you know, show up down there. And he was a beautiful horse too. And man, they just to see him down there, everybody drooled over him. And then he got the job done. You know, he won the Barbados Gold Cup. So that was a special moment too. I mean, I know my grandfather is a, you know, big supporter of Barbados, loves going down there for that race, but to win it with a horse like him, made that win just a little bit more special.
I remember that day. We broadcast that race here on HRRN, and Barbados is super special. And to watch Sir Dudley Diggs get the victory that day, knowing what he meant to you and to your dad and to the family, was really cool. You know, we talked earlier about the fact that you now have two young children, and part of your decision to go out on your own was the fact that, okay, now you can kind of control your own schedule. You're going to be the boss. So if you do get an opportunity to take an afternoon and go watch a recital, go watch a soccer game, a baseball game, whatever the case might be, you will have that flexibility to make that call and be able to do it. Your wife, Katie, she was a longtime jockey. She gave up a promising riding career, and it's turned out to be a wonderful decision. Tell me about having somebody by your side that understands the game the way that she does.
You know, I was fortunate. You know, a lot of the times people don't really understand, you know, the responsibilities that the trainers and assistant trainers have. You know, a lot of people don't understand why you can't be there to do something, why you've got to miss this, why you've got to miss that. Not a lot of people understand that. So I was very fortunate to have somebody that understood how things worked and you know, allowed me to do my job, but also, you know, be a father to my kids as well.
How did you meet?
Actually, we met at Keeneland. She was an exercise rider for the trainer that was in the barn across from me.
Wow. Does she still help, or will she help with your operation when you go out on your own?
No, she's home. She's going to take care of the kids. That's a full-time job in itself.
Yeah, is it ever? Is it ever? But that's what makes it work, right? You've got to have that balance, and I'm so glad that that's working out for you. Talking with Nolan Ramsey here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Nolan, there were so many other top horses that you've had the chance to be around in working with Mike Maker. Names like Red Knight and Atone and Zulu Alpha are names that come to mind. One of my favorites was the Big Hoss, because he was tough as nails. He showed up all the time. There was International Star and Field Pass and Oscar nominated. Talk to me about some of those other horses and things that you're always going to remember.
You know, it's funny. I bought a place in Florida, and you know, I guess you could say I decorated it myself. First time my mother came to see it, she was wondering why all the pictures on the walls were of wind photos and horses. You know, I'd never thought about it. And then I started looking, I said, you know, she's right. I said, every photo I've got on the wall is of a horse. And, you know, it's the horses that you mentioned. I've got, you know, Atone, I've got Zulu Alpha, I've got Bigger Picture, the Big Hoss, like those horses that, you know, the horses that are tough as nails, you know, the Big Hoss, he was tough. He was tough to work with. You know, he was a horse that was going to do what he wanted to do. And you just needed to, you know, allow him to do that. And, you know, another one that came to mind was Bigger Picture. He was a cool horse. He was tough. He was so tough. You know, he was a horse that showed up every time you let him up to the paddock. It didn't matter who he was running against. You know, those kind of horses, they're just very special. And you learn a lot from them too. Another horse that, you know, was probably one of my all-time favorites is a horse named Cross Border. You know, he was a son of English Channel. So he wasn't the most attractive looking horse, you know, a little bit on the narrower side, lighter framed, just not, you know, you think of a, you know, top level horse, and he's not really what you'd picture, but he would run his eyes out against anything you line him up against. You know, we took him to Saratoga the first year we had him. You know, he won three races in the same meet at Saratoga. And to win three races at a meet anywhere is one thing, but to do it in Saratoga, of all places, was extremely, extremely tough. And he showed up, and he was just one of those old knocking horses. It didn't matter. You know, you could line him up against grade one horses, and he showed up. And he was another one that was tough to deal with in the barn, had his own quirks. But, you know, I always like those kind of horses. And like I said, you learn a lot from them, too. You know, those are the horses that, you know, not necessarily you don't train them. They kind of train themselves, and you may just have to go with the flow. But, you know, there was an article on the Pollock Report that came out right when I announced I was going out, and there was a list of some horses that I'd, you know, worked with in my time with Mike. And, you know, just looking back at some of those names and thinking about some of those horses, it's like, you know, I feel so fortunate to be able to have worked with those horses, to be hands-on with those horses, to gain experience from those type of horses, because a lot of those horses are, you know, once-in-a-lifetime types of horses, and to have, you know, a handful of them, it's, you know, second to none.
Nobody is ever going to question your experience that you've gained over the years, ever since you were a young boy, and we talked about that earlier. But, Nolan, what do you expect your biggest challenges to be when you hang your own shingle outside the barn on May 1st?
You know, I think the truth of the matter is, you know, I'm just another name on the list. I've had the experience, I've got the knowledge, but I got to prove it. So I think my biggest challenge is going to be, you know, growing my name, growing my stable, being able to pick up, you know, some of the better horses, and really proving to people that, you know, I'm not just an assistant trainer, I can be a trainer too. I guess I got to, you know, put my money where my mouth is and show up and you know, make a name for myself. I'm very fortunate to have the opportunities I've had and, you know, grow up with the family that I've got. But at the end of the day, you know, I've got to make a name for Nolan Ramsey. I can't be, you know, Nolan Ken Ramsey's grandson.
Yeah. Do you see yourself falling into the Mike Maker mold? And what I mean by that is Mike Maker is a disciple of the Dwayne Lucas, Todd Pletcher training tree, right? So do you find yourself now maybe taking that baton and running with it and being the next in that next generation of Lucas and Pletcher and Mike Maker?
You know, I do. You know, it's what I've learned. You know, it's the ways I know. And you know, looking at the results, it's a pretty successful model. You know, there's been some really big names that have, you know, come from Wayne. So, you know, what he's teaching seems to be working, and obviously it's worked for Mike very well. So, you know, if I have half the career he's had, then I've done just fine.
I love asking this next question. I ask it all the time here on Trainer Talk because the answers are so cool. But if you were to be able to spend a day with one trainer, whether past, present, whatever the case might be, somebody that you could pick their brain, have dinner with them, talk to them about the profession of training racehorses, is there a trainer or maybe even a couple of trainers that come to mind for you?
Yeah, there's two. Unfortunately, I was too young when he passed to really get to sit down and ask him questions that, you know, I'd like to ask now. But I'd love to be able to have the opportunity to sit down with Bobby Frankel and really pick his brain. I think he's excellent trainer. You know, obviously he had horses from my grandparents. So, you know, I got to know him a little bit, but like I said, I was really too young to ask questions that I'd like to ask now. But Bobby Frankel's on the list, and another one I'd like to sit and really pick his brain would be Bill Mott. I mean, you take a look at his career, and I mean, from you know, past to present, I mean, it's just one champion after another. You know, his horses always look good. He's always competitive. You know, he's always you know, being talked about. It's amazing the career he's had and the horses he's had the opportunities to work with, and I'd love to sit and really pick his brain, hear his stories, ask him questions.
What do you think you would ask him?
I'd ask him how to find another cigar.
Yeah, that would that would be okay.
He's got a different, you know, it's a different mold than what I've learned and, you know, what I've seen. So I like him. Obviously, it's worked extremely well for him. So I just like to know, you know, how he operates, what it is that he does that, you know, gets the results that he's got, because it's been extremely successful for him. So just to see another way, to hear, you know, different opinions, I think is priceless.
Yeah, you'll get the opportunity to do that, I'm sure, at some point. Yeah, obviously you won't with Bobby Franco, but you will have that opportunity at some point with Bill Mott. And I think that that's a wonderful choice, considering everything that he's accomplished and what he continues to accomplish. I talked about, you know, winning the Eclipse Award this year as the leading trainer all those years after his most recent Eclipse Award for leading trainer. And it's just remarkable how he continues to do it year in and year out.
He's the model of consistency. It's worked very well for him, and, you know, very happy to see it. I think he's a class act. He's always been very kind to me and my family. And like I said, if I get the opportunity, I'd love to sit down and pick his brain.
Being a young trainer in this game, Nolan, are there things that you will do differently than trainers like a Bill Mott or maybe even a Shug McGahee? Sometimes they get referred to as being old school trainers, right? Will you do things a little bit differently as a young man getting started in this game?
Yeah, and I think I'm going to have to. You know, times have changed, especially here in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. You know, with the implementation of HISA, you know, with the, in my opinion, I feel that, you know, public perception has altered a lot of the way things are done at the racetrack. So, you know, I've been fortunate to learn the, you know, quote unquote old school way, but I'm also at the point in my life and the point in my career where I can see that, you know, things are going to need to change, that, you know, things need to be tweaked to be, you know, stable and have some longevity, and have a long career as well. So, you know, what those things are, I may not know yet, but, you know, the old school way of doing things is unfortunately going to have to change.
Can you still have longevity as a horse trainer and be successful for a long period of time, considering the current environment that we're working in? Is it still possible?
I think it's possible, but I certainly don't think it's easy. You know, you see a lot, I talk to a lot of these older guys, and, you know, they're struggling with the change. They're struggling to adapt. And, you know, I think it's kind of a win-lose situation for me. You know, I'm young. I'm just at the very beginning of my career. So I'll be able to adapt, you know, with the times, and instead of trying to maybe change what's already been, you know, been the way for so long. But like I said, I grew up learning the old school way. So, you know, I see the way, you know, these guys used to do things, and, you know, maybe some of them still do. And, you know, you learn a lot of things that way. So yeah, it's going to be tough to change the way you do things, but, you know, horse racing's changed a lot. And I think it's going to change more in the future too. So, you know, and, you know, to be able to have a long career doing this, you're going to have to be able to adapt.
Well, Nolan, I wish you all the best going forward. I know that we're edging closer to that date when you'll get to hang that shingle for yourself, and that's going to be a very proud moment. It's something you've been working toward for a very, very long time, ever since you were a young boy hanging out with your grandfather at the farm. So all the best to you and to your family going forward, my friend. I'm sure we'll be talking again soon. You said one of your goals is to win the Kentucky Derby for your grandfather. Let's make it happen, and I'll remember to get you back here on the program as soon as that happens.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Greatly appreciate it.
You got it, buddy. Nolan Ramsey here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Such a great story. How about the story he told about walking out of Saratoga with about 75K in his pocket, getting stopped in security? Oh, I can't even imagine. Wonderful stuff. If you missed any portion of the show, head back to the website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast. Do that, too, on every podcast platform. And follow us on social media, at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook, YouTube, and on Instagram. For my producer, Lee Delapina, for my special guest, Nolan Ramsey, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to this edition of Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton.